Hello, I'm Michelle McCorry, and this is KIPCO News coming to you from New York. President Biden will be unveiling part one of his two-pronged massive infrastructure plan on Wednesday. And the proposal is expected to total between $3 and $4 trillion. Now, to foot this bill, the Biden administration has been eyeing big tax increases with wealthier Americans and corporations as the primary targets. Joining me to discuss that and so much more is Dr. Ron Paul, former congressman and current host of the Ron Paul Liberty Report. Dr. Paul, thank you so much for joining us on KITCO.
Michelle, it's nice to be with you.
Great to have you, Dr. Paul. All right, let's start off by looking at the first part of this infrastructure bill, because it's expected to focus on rebuilding roads and bridges, expand clean energy investments, and create infrastructure for electric vehicles. Some are calling this a Trojan horse for the Green New Deal. Now, while the plan was initially thought to have a $3 trillion price tag, it now could cost as much as $4 trillion, and that could include a $3.5 trillion tax hike. So, Dr. Paul, what impact do you think the first part of this infrastructure bill is going to have on the U.S. economy?
Well, hopefully it would do something positive, but most likely it'll do what those kind of programs always do, you know, spend a lot of money. They're inefficient. They're always cost more than they thought they should. And besides, it's built on some mystical belief that you shouldn't have any concern about deficits. You shouldn't have any concern about what they're going to do with those deficits at the Federal Reserve. It's just more, everybody's in a dream. And this is part of it. So I would think that this is, you know, worse than average. Most of the time people say, well, this is a little bit too much and we ought to be cautious, and they have some people warning. But this is probably the most outrageous thing ever, considering what has been spent in the last year. And that was on top of us trying to come out of a recession that lasted for many, many years. And also, I think before coronavirus, our recession, our you know correction was already in motion. So I think this dream, they're convinced that deficits don't matter. They claim that what we have been doing, if you exaggerate it, you call it modern. It's a modern monetary theory. Well, the theory has been around a long time, but this is an insane monetary theory, and it causes a lot of harm. And I just think it's building now. And one of these days it's going to break loose and people are going to lose confidence in the purchasing power of the dollar. They just can't keep doing this. Other than if they can, they have defied all kind of common sense in history that all you have to do is have a monopoly monetary system, just print out the money. So for a while it lasts. And since there's a theory about the subjective theory of value, you can kid and fool people for a while. But eventually, this is going to lead to a great disaster, this type of spending. And I think the roads will continue to erode.
Well, we'll get to the impact that this could have on the dollar in a moment. But I want to focus on why you think this has become such a big issue in the United States. If we look at the second part of the bill, I mean, that is focused on the so-called care economy. And that bill is expected to include the largest expansion of the welfare state since LBJ's Great Society. It's going to include items like universal preschool, free community college, childcare, dependent care, paid leave. This is all supposed to be part of the package that's going to be announced at a later date. So what do you make of that? How did the U.S. government get so far to the left again?
Well, it's part of this dream. Everything they do in Washington is for political reasons. They don't have a desire to promote sound economic policy. In the old days, there was an attempt that, you know, they would recognize that deficits are bad, and they'd recognize that free market interest rates were beneficial, and there'd be always be a limit to it. But there isn't any now. And so the consequence is horrible. And I think it really got started in recent years, back in 2019, when the overnight rates exploded upward, saying this system isn't functioning, and interest rates had to go lower. It's since it doesn't make any sense, There's always going to be a political need. Right now, it was all exaggerated by coronaviruses because then we had the lockdown, and this has made the economy much, much weaker. But we were dealing already with a deeply flawed system, a lot of malinvestment, a lot of debt. Debt has to always be paid for one way or the other. It can be paid for by people working harder, or it can be paid for by devaluing the currency. And that is pay your bills off with printing press money.
Well, Dr. Paul, you're correct that the pandemic certainly served as an excuse and an accelerator, if you will, for these socialist policies. But to the trend towards socialism and leftist policies was happening way before the COVID pandemic and really taking a hold of American politics. Why do you think the United States is being pulled more and more to the left?
Because I think of the failure of the system. We really, because they divide everything up into right and left, and right is conservative and free markets, and there's the difference. No, it's a consequence of what you should expect when government is involved, and both parties are very interventionist. And, you know, they fight and fume over power. But in reality, they have the same policy. So if you're dealing with a policy, they're not trying to correct what was the policies that were mistakenly given to us by the right, because the right believes in deficits. They believe in warmongering. They believe in the Federal Reserve. They, you know, they share that. When they're fussing and fuming over things in the Congress where they're trying to impeach the president, they all show up to vote to spend the money. So it doesn't matter. And there's been a few things added in the last couple of years, and that is because it's a failing system, because it can't work, they've had to resort to even more spending, more benefits, more handouts, and also more protectionism. Thinking that, well, we're not as competitive, we have to do something. And it works into the foreign policy that there's more sanctions put on, more tariffs put on. And there was a time 10, 15 years ago, there was a significant segment of the economy intended to be more conservative that they weren't excited about tariffs. But now we use tariffs and we use these sanctions. And so we're looking for increasing the disturbance internationally. I think we have a global problem too. When you look at what's happened with our foreign policy in Syria and the Middle East and Afghanistan, Afghanistan's never going to end. I guess we ought to prepare for another 20 years. You're going to see an end to the dollar before we're going to see us leave Afghanistan and the Middle East and getting out of Syria.
Dr. Paul, I do want to get your thoughts on foreign policy, but first let's focus more on the Fed. And you've always been very vocal in your criticism of the Fed. And now there's growing concern that we're seeing the Fed and central banks around the world, in fact, losing their independence, that fiscal, monetary policy and political agendas are becoming far too intertwined. Yellen, former Fed chair, is now the Treasury Secretary, and we're seeing a similar pattern happening in Europe with ECB head Mario Draghi, now Italy's prime minister. And this potential loss of independence and the blur between government and central banks was recently highlighted by Senator John Neely Kennedy. Let's watch.
I see every day central banks getting more and more involved in fiscal policy and lobbying legislators with respect to the adoption of fiscal policy. I've noticed that the Bank of England has announced in its QE program that it is going to stop purchasing corporate bonds from companies that it thinks has too big of a carbon footprint. I've noticed recently that the Reserve Bank of New Zealand has decided it's going to start in its policy making, its monetary policy, taking account of housing prices. Now, this is where I'm headed, Mr. Chairman. The Federal Reserve needs to maintain its independence in America. Your credibility depends on political independence. I give you Turkey if you don't believe me.
So, Dr. Paul, the big picture here that Senator Kennedy is painting is that this is a phenomenon worldwide, that central banks and government policies and political agendas are getting too and too intertwined as opposed to being independent of one another. Do you see that?
Oh, yeah. I think it's just a feeble attempt to try to rescue a system that is bankrupt. I mean, this whole system is bankrupt. It is not workable. So they do this. But this whole idea of independence, I just don't believe that they're interested in independence. They're interested in secrecy, because I don't think of the Treasury and the Federal Reserve and the fiscal people in the Congress as really representing a whole lot, because I think about the people that we place in the shadow government, in the deep state, because there's people pulling strings that have a lot of power and clout. They never ask me. You know, I was on the banking committee for all those years. I couldn't even go to the open market committee meeting. So there was no way that would be permissible. So it is controlled by outsiders. But and I think that this sort of shows, you know, with two Federal Reserve people in charge at Treasury and at the Federal Reserve, and it's all a rescue operation. And they think they can do it. And they have pulled the rabbits out of the bag many times. And you think this thing isn't going to last, but they end up doing it and they continue to do it. So they agree on this. But I don't think that it's just a matter of independence. Giving the Federal Reserve more independence has nothing to do with helping the problem, because they're way, way too independent and secretive and out of the control of the Congress. The only things that we should be doing, if we seriously want to understand it, is have a thorough audit and find out what goes on behind the scenes, and then get rid of the Federal Reserve. We didn't have a central bank for a long time, and they're all over the world. But like you pointed out, Michelle, they're failing all around the world. You know, the fiscal people are getting together with others. The environmental people want to get ahead in the front of the line so they get their thing. But it's all of it is put on the weight of believing that they can maintain the integrity of the purchasing power of the dollar, which I do not believe they can continue to do this, because sometimes they even hide the figures of really, you know, what's happening. Even now, you know, it's getting more confusing even to keep up with the money supply figures. You know, they don't reveal it. It's difficult and say that's not important. But ultimately, is debt motivating all of them to agree that you must print the money in an unlimited fashion, no matter what we say publicly?
All right. So if we are seeing the potential collapse of the dollar, Dr. Paul, what replaces it?
Well, that's the big question, because nobody knows. There's nothing there to replace it right now. If we get into the chaos, which is very possible, that's what's going to happen. You have social destruction. You have something like if it ever got so bad, it'd be like a Venezuela, you know, and something like that. I can't believe that we're that stupid to go that far. But no, they need monetary reform. Even if they don't go in the direction I want, they're going to have to do something. But they would have to, politically, it's not likely, because politically, economically, it involves living within our means a little bit, you know, cutting back a little bit of spending. But nobody really is serious, maybe three or four people. Nobody thinks they're going to cut anything. There's no way that they're going to cut it and improve things in that manner. So they have to start thinking. And I worry about the economic chaos, but also the social chaos that's going on. I live in Texas, and I keep thinking Texas has avoided some of the really dumb stuff in New York City and Chicago and Detroit. But even Austin has street people now with tents out there, and we're a wealthy state and still doing pretty well. But no, this is a consequence of bankruptcy, and they're fidgeting and they're picking out victims and they're scurrying around. But everybody gets a bailout because they don't have anything else they can do. And that's why you can depend on the destruction of the currency in hopes that they'll wake up and do something. But there aren't very many examples that right in the middle of a chaos like this, they say, oh, let's do common sense. Let's have this vote to cut the budget by 3%. You know, that'd be a civil war. They're going to wait for the civil war that's going to come when you don't cut anything and your purchasing power goes down 10%. then there'll be real chaos.
So Dr. Paul, how does one protect oneself against this looming chaos? What is the best way to protect one's personal finances? What is the strategy that you would advocate?
Well, there's a couple of things. I'm not the financial advisor, but I am one that thinks about survival and investments. But no, I think people should be looking at investments that endure in conditions like that. And that is investing in the precious metals, having land, learning how to take care of oneself and being prepared. But that's being threatened all the time, even defending yourself now. I talked to somebody the other day about this subject. He says, I have a gun. He says, but I can't even buy ammunition anymore. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be determined. And that is why the threat really now is they'll do what they have to do. They'll take the guns if they need to. But what else are they going to do when it comes to taking care of the people? They're going to confiscate. They'll confiscate the gold. You know, they did it in the 30s. They'll do it again. Well, I don't really believe they're ready to do that. But that's a threat always that they'll confiscate the gold. But
yeah.
The government is the threat. And that is why, if you really care about this subject, you have to participate in the preservation of liberty. That's why I like to talk to people at Kitco.
Well, Dr. Paul, let's focus on this threat of potential gold confiscation or one form or other of government intervention, because that concern is rising. We have investment greats like Ray Dalio, Michael Burry saying that safe haven assets are not necessarily going to be so safe from government intervention. They're saying expect possible tax changes or regulation that will prevent a flight of capital to these assets that could be viewed as an alternative to the dollar, like gold, like Bitcoin. Could they be at risk of a government crackdown?
Oh, absolutely. And that's what's not believable. You know, when countries go through, these periods of euphoria where bubbles are blown up. A lot of times people will be taken in but eventually everybody becomes gullible and they have to try to protect themselves. So these types of euphorias usually end, but that's the reason why, yeah, some are going to make it. Some will have their private airplanes. Some will get out of here and some will survive. At the minimum, not right now, they're benefiting from the bailouts. Nobody, the wealthy didn't get poorer in this last bailout. So it's always a threat, but the government is the threat. Because they will crack down, because they have the ability to do it. And that's why I'm so positive that we need more people saying, yes, what is this free society you talk about? Well, we had a taste of it. Our Constitution, if you don't know where to start or understand it, just start with the Constitution. You know, that might give you an idea of what a free society is all about. And they'll say, most people in Washington say, that's old fashioned. That we can't do. Nobody cares about that.
So, but Dr. Paul, what form of a crackdown do you think that this could take when we talk about assets like gold and even Bitcoin potentially being at risk of government intervention, at higher taxes, at regulation? What do you think could happen to those assets?
I think all of that can happen. The tax system will be used. But just printing money is a tax. I say all you have to do is spend money and run up the debt. That is a tax, because if people won't loan you the money, which they won't, then they have to print the money, and the devaluation of the currency becomes a tax. So the tax is going up, but they will do it for public relations reason. They will have to show that they're putting a heavy tax on the very wealthy because of the civil strife that's going on. So that will happen. But it's something that should be preventable. It's really hard to take care of once it breaks out. And that's why people are really so scared. But I think there are two parts of it. One is we have the financial bankruptcy. Most people understand it. Too much debt, printing money, borrowing, this sort of thing. But the other is the moral bankruptcy. If you look at it and what's going on in this country with this attack on freedom of speech, an attack on the values of our Western civilization, boy, that is a big deal. And that represents a bankruptcy, a moral bankruptcy. And that is what probably will become more important than just dealing with the financial bankruptcy. But I think they're both. And we have a financial bankruptcy and a moral bankruptcy. Right. And we've never had to go through this quite like this before.
So how do you fight against that, Dr. Paul? How do you fight against the moral bankruptcy combined with a potential financial bankruptcy? You say to champion liberty, that's certainly what you're doing, but what does that mean in effective terms?
Well, I do it by what I'm doing and have done all my life. People say, did you go into politics? I know I never was in politics, never involved, didn't want to be in politics. All I wanted to do was speak out. And that began in the 1970s with actually literally the day after the breakdown of the Bretton Woods. And that was August 15th of 1971. That was an impressive moment for me because this is introducing an age of, you know, really bad stuff for us in the world. And of course, gold back then had been 20, went up to 35, and at $35 an ounce, and look at where it's been. Yeah, today it's down, and tomorrow it might be down. But the ultimate protection against it so far through 5,000 years of history has always been the precious metal. And I think they manipulate that price. They try to penalize people who know that and want it. So they manipulate prices of gold and silver. At the same time, they will confiscate it if they have to. I don't think they're on the verge of doing that. But I think that I'm in the education business is what I'm really involved right. in, you know, homeschooling and trying to get people to understand Austrian free market economics, because if they don't understand that, nothing can come of it, because I think all the bad stuff is a result of bad ideas. We haven't had Austrian economics taught in our schools for the past 50 years. We've been having Keynesian socialist economics that deficits don't matter. And no respect for the Constitution. And this makes a big difference. And they think that they can just do this materialistically. Well, right. If I print more money and pass it out, everybody's going to be okay. But it's not going to work.
All right. In today's interview, we have Doug Casey. Doug Casey is not only a legendary gold and commodities investor or speculator, but he's also one of the more interesting and I would say accurate philosophers, or really, I would say essentially critic of our financial system and the way our society has continued to move, and someone that I thoroughly enjoy speaking to every chance that I get. Now, right there down below, you'll see the link to Doug's newest book, which is Assassin. It's a really interesting fiction book, adventure, also, you know, has got the legendary philosophies of Doug involved in it. I'm presently reading his book, which is called Totally Incorrect. It's a good laugh. It is a very funny book on a lot of stories. And so without further ado, thank you to our channel sponsor, which is Vizsla Silver. Thank you, Vizsla Silver. So make sure you hit the like button on this side right over there, this side right over there. And let's dive right into the video. How you doing, Doug?
Fine and dandy, Jake. I've gotten into the habit of saying fine and dandy since George Carlin, in one of his videos, drew it to my attention. It's a strange way of describing how you are, fine and dandy. Anyway, that's the way I feel, fine and dandy.
So what do you think would happen to George Carlin if he was doing his same bits right now?
Well, I wish I'd gotten to know him. I wish I'd met him when he was still alive, because he really was a comic genius. And he was a great thinker. And I love the philosophy that he interweaves in a lot of his comedy. So, and I think predictably, he became much more cynical and even bitter in his later years, because he's seen enough to know that life on this planet is really kind of a tragedy. In fact, I'll go so far as to say that if I'm reincarnated, I don't want to come back to this planet because there are just too many crazy chimpanzees running around, and they're really getting out of control.
You're right. They are getting a little out of control here. So one of the things that I wanted to ask you, and that you're looking out right now and you go, things are getting a little, I mean, we had a government lockdowns that have put, you know, we just talk a lot about America, of course, but think about in a lot of developing countries, you're in Uruguay, you know, a lot of these places all around the world really relied off tourism. That's been shut down. So not only in America and Canada, do you have a lot of people that are unemployed and can't pay their rent, can't pay their mortgage, but you think globally, and that's rarely taken into account in the news cycles in a lot of the Western worlds. And so we've got this place where the stock market's kind of teetering. People are wondering, you know, are they going to let this thing go down? Are they going to go into hyperspeed? And so I'm curious, what's your assessment right now on what is happening in the world and in the global political, socio, and financial system that we have?
Excuse my dog, she's friendly. Well, look, as much as anything else, my main interest for reading is history. And as much as anything else, ancient history. It's an excellent background because you for watching current events, because history puts things in perspective. You can see that everything has happened before. Human nature hasn't changed since people started writing this stuff down. And, you know, history stories basically always end badly. It's the rise and fall of the Roman Empire writ large is what we're seeing today in the U.S. Look, everything in the world, all organizations, start out as a good idea, something fun, something interesting, something constructive. And then it evolves into a business, and eventually it winds up as a scam or a swindle. And that's true of countries as well. It was true of ancient Rome, was actually true of ancient Athens, and it's certainly true of the U.S., and I'm afraid that it's actually worse, more serious than that, because the colors of the map on the wall, like Al Stewart said, are always running. So nothing lasts forever when it comes to political entities. But I'm afraid it's much more serious than just a greater depression for the United States. It's going to be all over the world, and it's worse than that, because Western civilization itself is under attack. And Western civilization is, to start with, it's the only civilization in world history that's ever amounted to anything. Yes, I know that the Chinese have done wonderful things in the past. I like Confucius, I like Lao Tse much better. Yes, that's all wonderful. And I appreciate Sichuan cooking, and I appreciate yoga from the Indians, but that's about it. Everything else that we have in the world comes from Western civilization, and it's actively under attack. I mean, it's not just being disregarded. You've got people out there that are actually overtly trying to destroy Western civilization and everything that it's given us. So we're at a major turning point, I think, in world history. So what's coming onto us now is not just another economic downturn. It's not just another depression. It's much more serious. I hate to be so gloomy to start out the interview, but I guess you asked a question, and that's kind of my answer.
Yeah, well, that's why I always look forward to talking with you. I think a lot of people have not only businesses and various things to that they want to discuss when we talk. And you care about what the future looks like outside of just purely an investment. And that's what's always made me very interesting. What I found interested in your work and why I like having you on so much. And so it's something that I'm very concerned about with a 7-month-old daughter. And so my question to you is, do you believe that this is intentional?
Well, I'm not a conspiracy-oriented guy. And the reason I tend to push most conspiracy theories aside. Not that there aren't conspiracies. People conspire all the time. It's like Adam Smith said in Wealth of Nations. I mean, whenever you get a group of men in the same business together, they always conspire against the public to their own advantage. So this is nothing new. The reason why I don't believe in grand conspiracy theories per se is because it's hard enough to get 3 or 4 friends to decide what movie to see. Well, scratch that. Nobody sees movies anymore and really hasn't for years. But what restaurant to go to? Well, forget that. There aren't any restaurants open anymore. Anyway, it's hard enough to just get some friends to agree on something, much less to get hundreds of active criminal sociopaths together to agree on something. So, on the other hand, I do believe in the deep state, so-called, because there are people that share a view of the world that have a certain psychological makeup, and generally speaking, you know, they like to control other people as opposed to controlling the physical universe. Easier to control people than to control stuff. So, and these people generally gravitate towards governments because governments are all about coercion, force, controlling people. That's what they do for a living. So you get a certain type of person, basically a criminal personality, that's drawn to an entity where they can control other people using force. That's government. And so people say, well, yeah, the deep state, isn't that a conspiracy? Well, not really, because although they get together at things like Bilderberger and Bohemian Grove and Davos and the CFR, things like that, lots of, you know, clubs that they belong to, I question whether there's actually a formal conspiracy. But whenever you have people that have the same worldview and are working around the same entity, yeah, it kind of looks like a conspiracy. Yeah, it kind of does. And they're in positions of power where they can enforce these things on the rest of us. But, you know, even if they concede, even if they succeed with their conspiracy of world domination, and for a while there's a bald-headed guy with a white cat, you know, in control of things. These people are all criminal personalities. And they'll start conspiring again with each other, you know, to destroy the guy next to them or the guy that's coming up the ladder below them. So it's not a formal conspiracy per se. It's just the way the world works. I don't know if I'm being clear with that or not, Jake.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. So one of the, when you look at it all, and I'm more concerned with some of the times I get crap from people that just want me to only talk about investments and that's it, right? And one of the reasons that I like having you on is you're kind of the same way, you know, going back, you've always looked at the broader social situation. But one of the terms in your book, totally incorrect, was written about you in the foreword, and it was called drop dead money. And it was a story about you being the keynote speaker. And it was when Dick Cheney was campaigning with Bush, and he was, you know, the big hot dog there, and someone introduced you guys, and you pulled your hand behind your back, told him you weren't going to shake his hand, and then proceeded to tell him why Democrats and Republicans, both sides of the aisle, how terrible it is, essentially. And the writer said that it was one of the most interesting memories that he has of you telling him off like that. And he called it drop dead money. And he said, there's very few people in the world that have drop dead money. And, you know, you've been able to build your fortune. And I believe that one of the reasons we talk a lot about finances is I believe one of the only ways with the trajectory society is going on for us to ensure our freedom is essentially going to be to have enough money to be able to opt out more out of the system, which, you know, then can lead to a plethora of things. So how does one go about getting drop dead money? And if you knew everything you knew, but you were, you know, 20 years old and it was 2021 and you knew everything that was happening in the world and where it was heading and the lockdowns and the financial system, what would you do to get drop dead money in present time?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's the $64 question. And look, when I was 20 years old, I had some vague ideas. I had my own way of looking at the world. I was always a gut libertarian, even before I'd even heard that word. In other words, I've always believed in free minds, free markets, and everybody should do what they'd like as long as they don't physically damage anybody else or their property. That keeps it pretty simple, okay? You don't need a library full of law books. All you need to know is, in fact, even the Ten Commandments are too much. I can't even remember all the Ten Commandments, to tell you the truth, certainly not in order, apart from the fact that there are several different versions of the Ten Commandments. That's too many. You know, primitive people count two, three, many, because you get beyond three, you know, the numbers start becoming academic. I believe there's only two laws. Do all that you say you're going to do, and don't aggress against other people or their property. That's pretty simple. Almost anybody can remember two simple things that are kind of intuitive. Okay, getting back to your question and how that relates to it. Look, somebody that's 20, I think it's a good idea to establish a moral basis for yourself. You gotta be pretty certain in your own mind what's right and what's wrong, what you should do and what you shouldn't do. Because, you know, you're always confronted with moral decisions in life. And you make the wrong ones sometimes. You may not regret it now, but it's been said, you'll regret it soon and for the rest of your life. And especially when you're young, you don't want to make mistakes that you're going to regret the rest of your life. So I think it's very important that you try to establish a moral grounding for yourself. It'll help keep you from cheating and stealing and lying to your friends, things like that, that you'll always regret, and hurting other people, which you'll regret. Most people don't think about this stuff. I mean, God, I don't know if this is what preachers talk about in Sunday school or not, but probably not. Probably not. They talk about theology, which is one of the most, you know, one of the most foolish ways you can misallocate time. Okay, getting back to the question. I mean, having kind of laid that preamble down, look, when I got out of college, all I wanted to do, and I shouldn't have gone to college, that was the first mistake, it was very stupid of me. Of course, when I went to college in the 60s, it was kind of a privilege. Not many people went to college. I mean, most people just went to work out of high school. So if you're a college guy, it was kind of a big deal, even though college wasn't very expensive back then in real terms. But, well, my computer is running low. Just a minute, I've got to plug this bad boy in.
No worries. I'll cut this right here and jump cut it back in.
That's okay. I got it. Okay. So, anyway, we could talk about one mistake that people about age 20 are doing today is they're mortgaging their future financially by going to college. And just as important or more important, they're misallocating or wasting 4 years of time, or worse than wasting. They're subjecting themselves to indoctrination from college professors who are almost all today Marxists or socialists or radical progressives or serious liberals or something like that. Almost all of them are today, just a fact. So the first thing, or the second thing at this point I'd say is, other than trying to establish a moral foundation, is don't waste time going to school. I mean, this is crazy that everybody thinks you have to, that it's a way up the ladder to success and progress, college I'm talking about. And incidentally, I'm not talking about learning, which is a totally different thing. That's something you do for yourself. That's not something that is bequested on you by some overpriced, corrupt institution. So I'd say if you're in school, college, drop out, especially if you're taking something, some soft thing like English or political science or history, or these things are totally corrupt. If you're taking a hard science or math, okay, different story perhaps. But so what do? You're going to save yourself that $100,000 or $200,000 that you would have pissed away sitting in a classroom listening to some moron yap, most of which you won't remember, but some of it's going to insinuate itself into your brain and corrupt it. You know, when you're of a certain age and an authority figure says something, especially an authority figure that you're paying to listen to, hey, you take it as truth. Even, you know, subtly, you take it as truth. So, okay, big point. Don't go to college today. Use that 4 years and the money you'd save to do something intelligent. Now, what might that be? I'll give you a practical plan. You're looking for specific advice, okay? Here's some specific advice. There's a company, I forget the name of it. I'm sure people that know how to use the internet properly can look it up in a moment. That if you spend a few thousand dollars and 6 weeks of time, will teach you how to build a house from the foundation on up to the wiring and the plumbing and the roofing and everything. This is a valuable skill. Houses are everywhere in the world. People live in them. It's a fantastic thing to know from all kinds of points of view. Okay, that is like a 2 month block where instead of drinking beer and chasing girls and wasting your time, basically, I mean, you can do that stuff anywhere, anytime, you're learning a real skill. Even if you don't want to be in the house building business, doesn't matter. You're going to pick up all kinds of stuff. Like, I've got other suggestions, but I'm just going to use this one as a... I'm just going to use this as a springboard to go on. It's that, did you ever read Robert Persig's book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance?
Yes.
Okay. And the point he makes there, among others, great book, is that, listen, you can be a greasy, ignorant-looking motorcycle mechanic, but if you're going to be a good one, you're going to have to learn how to torque down bolts and how not to, you know, put a gasket in without overcompressing it. So you're going to have to learn how to, say, use a torque wrench and a little bit about metallurgy. Now, copper is different from lead and different from zinc. And if you're intellectually inquisitive, you start learning a lot about chemistry. And if you start learning about chemistry, you follow into physics. And from physics, you get into astronomy. And from astronomy, you get into philosophy. And philosophy, you get into literature. So even though you're still earning your living as a really excellent motorcycle mechanic, because you know all the, you know, details, you're not just being a robot playing playing with stuff on a motorcycle. You actually know how it works, but you learn all these other things too. So that's why I say, take this course on house building, for instance. Okay, what's next? Or first, maybe, like a friend of mine just did, go to Israel for a month. Several advantages. I'm not a Jew, nothing about Israel, but you go there and you're going to see a different country. That's great. That's part of the program, incidentally, is travel a lot, see a lot of different countries. But maybe during that month, why would you go to Israel in particular? I'd go there to take a month-long course in Krav Maga. Now, I've taken martial arts most of my life, and they're wonderful. A lot of advantages to them, but for actual fighting, they're great to have. Boxing is better than most martial arts, incidentally. But you do a month of Krav Maga, you've got the basics. It's basically street fighting. It's mixed martial arts. Very valuable skill to have. So do that, okay? Now you've seen a foreign country, you've picked up a martial arts skill. What's the next thing that you might want to do? Well, there are courses of all types. And while you're doing all this stuff, you ought to be listening to selected YouTube videos. You ought to be reading, you know, a couple hundred important books that are interesting and fun. And that's how you educate yourself. You don't need or want today college. In fact, when anybody comes to work for us, and I just sold my company, the rest of my company, thank you, Jesus. glad I did that. That was a good pass. But when I was still somewhat involved in the company, when somebody wanted a job with us, they like to say, yeah, when I was in college, I took a course in economics. And I'd ask them, well, you know, I'd say, now, why'd you go to college? Why'd you take economics? What did you learn? How much did you, were you corrupted? And God forbid somebody was an MBA. And I said, didn't you really have anything better to do with like $20,000 or $30,000 or $50,000 and a year or two of your life other than, you know, sit there? Why weren't you starting a business instead of learning to be an employee? So anyway, that's what you should be doing when you're 20. Spend that 4 years of time that you would spend in college learning specific things, okay? By doing. I mean, you can learn by reading and watching all the while, but you take specific courses and things to learn by doing. And I'm trying to think of some other courses like that, but there's just a load of them. I mean, it could be, look, if it was possible today, in today's world, overregulated as it is, it's probably impossible, I'd go to work for a carnival for 2 or 3 months. Why? Just to get to know carny people. I mean, lowlifes, shysters, you know, con men, you know. Hey, that's cool. If you don't have any money and you're just a kid, you're not going to get hurt. But you're going to pick up all kinds of interesting data about the way the world works. Good. You don't want to do that the rest of your life, but you do want to spend 3 months there. If you're on, you know, if you're economically impoverished or of a certain mind step, it's okay to join the military for 2 years. I basically despise the military, but, you know, I know lots and lots of soldiers have some experience in the area. If you're of a certain mind and background and circumstances, nothing wrong with doing that for 2 years. It's not long enough to be corrupted, but you'll get some more experience. Hopefully you won't have to, you know, go to some strange foreign country, meet interesting people and kill them. But, you know, there's all kinds of things you can do. I'm just saying, don't go to college. There's lots of stuff that'll put you head and shoulders above your would-be classmates. If you do all this stuff that I'm talking about, long list, I'm just scratching the surface. But I think you get the idea. After 4 years, if you want to go to college for some reason, which I don't know why, you're going to be so far ahead of the people in school. Well, for one thing, you're going to get laid a lot, but because you've got all this experience. Although, frankly, in today's world, frankly, I wonder why a young male would even want to hook up with a young female, because in this PC society, it's like an invitation to be sued now or 20 years later. So, and of course, you got to travel a lot. That's very important. You know, get enough money together to buy a round the world ticket, set up so you can stop everywhere and stay places. Tickets like that exist. I believe they still exist. And do it. Grab a backpack. You know, of course, I guess hitchhiking around the Southern Hemisphere isn't as easy as it once was, but you've done that, Jake.
Yeah, well, everything you said is what really changed my life, you know, and got me really far ahead, you know, now at 29 years old and, you know, some really great businesses and a lot of good success with stuff because I dropped out when I was a freshman in college. And by the time I would have been a senior, I'd already written 2 books. And so, you know, obviously when you're a doctor or something like that, you need the necessary schooling to get the employment opportunity. But as you said, for a lot, you don't. And when you focus on that one thing where you give yourself the opportunity to find those things and develop the skill at it, you know, by the time you're 27, 28 years old, you can be really quite far ahead at something. And I think a lot of it comes from social brainwashing, though. Like, you wouldn't believe the amount of crap that I got from everybody for doing that when I did. As I told you, my first book begins with me raising my hand, asking my teacher why we couldn't audit the Federal Reserve. And he basically told me to shut up. And I got in a fight with him in class, and everyone else wanted me to shut up too, because they just wanted to memorize the textbook. And almost everybody I knew said I was crazy. You know, people cried. Which is such a, it's so blown out of proportion. But it was difficult because it made me unsure of myself when all the volume outside of me was pressed one way and everything we're told about society and the world. And it made me start to, that's what's gotten me really interested in psychology. And because there is a mass brainwashing that has taken place, and you see that form especially clear in 2020 with, you know, people with face visors with their windows up wearing gloves, you know, but it manifests in all areas of our life, not just that. And so what's your thoughts on that? I was reading some old transcripts of your interviews with Porter Stansberry, and he said that one time you stood up on stage and you said that everyone was whipped dogs and they had to roll on their back and pee themselves. And you were talking about the mentality of our society to follow the herd. And you were saying about how the problem is that essentially we aren't conditioned to have self-respect or self-confidence. And I was wondering if you could touch on that and the philosophies of self-confidence and also this larger brainwashing rant that I just did. What's your thoughts?
Well, there can be a fine line between self-confidence and arrogance. And one of the differences between them is that if you have self-confidence, it comes naturally because you know that you have certain skills that you know you've gained and proven to yourself you have these skills. You know that you have knowledge, and perhaps by the time you've gained those things, you kind of realize that most people don't. I mean, they're basically watching TV and drinking beer and going to a job like a robot and then spending the money that they earn and going nowhere. So self-confidence is something that you get for yourself. Of course, there are a lot of people that look like they're self-confident, but they're like a door made out of balsa wood, because you know, that's so you know, they're like making pretend that they have self-confidence because they want to be the alpha dog in the pack, okay? And you know, so you pretend. Yeah, that's not a formula for success. So I guess the answer to the question is you've got to, I think you've got to be, look, there's lots of ways of dividing people. One way, it's kind of interesting, is you can be inner-directed or outer-directed. Now, what does that mean? If you're inner-directed as you're flying through life, it's like you got a gyroscope that's guiding you. So you don't get thrown off balance. But I think most people are radar-directed. Wherever they go, depends on bouncing around and seeing what's going on with others and what other people think and believe. So it's valuable. Yeah, I mean, it's good to have radar and a plan, but I think for a human going through life, it's better to have an inner gyroscope. And that's the basis of self-confidence.
So you said earlier that you were describing how we essentially just mindlessly do things our whole life and spend the little money we have from this thing that doesn't fulfill us, which is also backed up by data. The Gallup poll said about 75% of people are actively disengaged from their jobs, which I guess is a more politically correct way to say 75% of people hate what they do. And, you know, we're in this situation where we are in a place where we have created this weird society where there's so much angst and fear, and there's so many people that are barely just getting by. And so my question is, how does one find the courage then to go against the grain? Is it because you quite simply you find an inner purpose or an inner meaning? And then that goes back to what you said at the beginning, which is about living with morality and values. And you basically, it's essentially becomes a philosophy of life to pursue your goals.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, there's an old saying, and actually, there's a lot of wisdom in a lot of old sayings. That's why they're old sayings. Because, you know, it's that too soon old, too late smart. And a lot of people realize these things when they get old through sad experience. It's better to look, when I was in high school, and I went to a four-year boarding military school, okay? And so maybe in some ways that gave me a leg up on most people. It didn't work because it was an academically challenging, in other ways challenging environment. But I never had any good counsel there. If I'd had good counsel, somebody would have tried to act as a mentor and help me figure out what I really wanted to do, what was important to me, what wasn't important to me, starting with, well, all the kids in your class are going to college. Do you want to go to college? If so, why? And what could you do at the time? Blah, blah, blah. So I don't know what the answer to the question is. It really helps to have, you know, somebody that's willing to spend the time guiding you. I mean, there's so many people that spend a couple hundred dollars an hour talking to a psychiatrist later in life, trying to undo the errors and omissions that they made earlier in life. So it's best not to make those errors and omissions to start with. I don't know if that's an answer or not.
I know. I think it's great. I think you're right. I think that we essentially need to. I think of you like a philosopher rather than an investor. And then your philosophy on life led you to commodities and gold and silver and these investments that ended up making you a bunch of money. And so, you know, I like to think of you as a philosopher, and I like to think of the way for us to break out of this basically, you know, mass brainwashing that's happened by the elites of the world and the high societies of the world. The only way to break out of it is essentially to build our own philosophy. Otherwise, we're programmed to live out society's designated philosophy, which obviously is not a very good one. And so that's why I've always found you to be a pretty interesting guy, because I think you talk about essentially being a philosopher. Now, I want to ask you in a moment some rapid fire questions, just questions that I had in my head over the last couple of weeks that I was just like, I'd like to ask Doug this. And, you know, I figured you'd have some pretty interesting takes on what was happening. So does that sound good to you?
Yeah, let's do it. I hope my answer, my answers to these questions are short, not too long.
All right. So what is a better investment right now if somebody had a couple hundred grand? Is it to buy a second passport outside of a major, you know, G whatever country in the United States, Canada, what have you, get a second passport and get out of the country? Or is it better to get land outside of the country or land wherever, someplace that, you know, if shit really does hit the fan, you know, which of those two?
Well, it's all a question of how much money you have to start with and actually what age you are. But okay, a couple hundred grand, that's doable for a lot of people, most people, I guess. Well, I don't know if most, but because they say that 40%, 50% of Americans can't even lay their hands on $500 for an emergency. So anyway, let's say a couple hundred grand. Look, investment-wise, your biggest risk, your biggest danger today is political, not financial. I mean, the markets today are floating on air. They're like Wile E. Coyote in the cartoon when he walks off a cliff. That's where they are. I mean, there's nothing below them. But as great as those financial risks are, your political risks are greater. So yeah, if you can, and there are a number of ways you can get it for free, by, you know, if you're of certain European backgrounds, Irish, Italian, Polish, maybe Lithuanian, British, there's a few others. You can become a citizen of another country. Very smart, because your passport is U.S. government property. You don't own it. That's one thing you should do. And I think it's important to have a crib someplace in the world where you can store your stuff. I mean, Superman's got to have his fortress of solitude, as it were. So, yeah, that's important. Or, you know, just as part of your life experience, pick a country and go and live there and become a citizen. And you'll pick up a language as well, which is usually one of the requirements for becoming a citizen. So I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah, I was just curious which one you would rank.
I hate to give specific investment advice because, look, you tell people, buy this. And if they buy it and it goes down, you're an idiot. And if they buy it and it goes up, it's because they're a genius. So it's a no-win proposition, telling people what to do with their money. Also, if you need to ask for investment advice, you shouldn't be making an investment. It's something that you got to know enough about the subject that you can make your own decision instead of listening to somebody touch you on something. So that's part of the answer too.
Yeah. So obviously that wasn't a super big investment question in terms of, you know, stock, a commodity, right? I was just curious where you ranked in terms of a passport versus having land. Now, let me ask you a question I've been thinking a lot about recently, which is what happens to the gold when the United States invades Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, whatever? Where does the gold go from these places?
Did you see that movie with, I think, George Clooney? I think it was called Three Kings.
Yeah, I just watched it the other day, and I wanted to ask you what you think happens to it.
Or there's another one that's really kind of a takeoff from. It was Kelly's Heroes with Clint Eastwood about World War II.
I haven't seen that one.
Oh, it may even be better, because it's actually a very subtle comedy where the American army hears that the Germans have a lot of gold stored someplace, and basically the ordinary soldiers launch an assault on the Germans to steal the gold. And it's a very, very good movie, Kelly's Heroes, talking about that. So Look, it's like I've known a lot of mercenaries in my life that have run around third world countries doing stuff. And a lot of people think, well, gee, it'd be great to have the training and be a mercenary. And the going rate is about $10,000 a month, tax-free, or at least the U.S. government's not going to know you're getting it, and they better not find out either. But basically, these guys are in that not to collect the money, but to rob the local banks. I mean, that's basically what it's about. The mercenary companies are there to tie up mineral rights and things like that for performing their services. So how did I get off on that tangent?
Where's the gold go, though, do you think, right? Where's because that was go? a funny movie, but where does it go? To the Federal Reserve? Does it go to a bank in Switzerland? Because that's a lot of gold, Libya and Saddam's gold.
I'll tell you what I've heard. And of course, there's no, this isn't reported in any official publications by the IMF or whatever. But okay, what happened to Libya's gold? Libya had a lot of gold. When Gaddafi was, after he was murdered. Well, it turns out, it's said, a lot of that gold was stolen by central bank officials, and they went off to Saudi Arabia, as Idi Amin did, actually. Idi Amin, after he left Uganda, after being one of the most, but not the worst, criminal dictator on the continent, he stole most of Uganda's gold, put it on a plane and flew off to Saudi Arabia. Those are two examples. But where did the gold that Saddam had, where did it go? Gee, I've never seen it reported. I mean.
Well, that's why I'm asking you. What happened was I that question came to my head and I asked it on Twitter, and then somebody said, watch the movie Three Kings, and it's a fun movie, but that's not what happens to it. And so, yeah, that was what I was curious. Does it go to a central bank in Israel? Does it go to a Swiss bank? When the United States goes into Afghanistan and Iraq and whatever else, Libya, whatever other places, they obviously have gold. And so I was curious. There's no right answer, right? There's no right answer, but I was just curious.
Because the guys that are in and around the government or the military, they're not so stupid that they're going to advertise the fact that most of it is actually stolen and sequestered someplace. I mean, that's actually what the name of the game is. You never hear about it. It's just kind of, let's forget about it and disappears. And of course, there have been these rumors for many years, because the Federal Reserve has never been audited. Is there actually 261 million ounces of gold in Fort Knox and in New York? Well, they say there is, but you really should do an audit if you're running, you really should. Or maybe it's still there, but it's all been hypothecated. Somehow, and somebody else, who knows? I mean, this is an accident waiting to happen when people don't know these things.
Yes, I don't know the answer to it either. But when I was thinking of it, and I had you on the schedule, I said Doug would be an interesting person to ask this question to, because it seems like there'd be a lot of gold with that. So I've heard Jim Sinclair say before that he thinks that eventually the deep money that controls the global financial system will one day let the price of gold run, or maybe even manipulate it to the upside or what have you in a really major way. Do you think that that's a possibility, or are you in the camp where you think something like that wouldn't occur?
I think the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government have already lost control of these things. I think the next step is going to be much higher interest rates, because they can't buy any more bonds by printing money to buy the government's bonds. I mean, the dollar is, we might have a credit collapse first, or in different parts of the economy while the dollar is being inflated out of existence. But we're really on the edge of the abyss. I mean, it doesn't seem like it right now. Everything seems pretty normal still. But I'm going to be really surprised, and I hope I am surprised, but I'm going to be really surprised if the economy doesn't go into full collapse and starts looking like chaos within the next year, maybe by the end of this year. But I don't know if I answered that question directly or.
So what do you think they're,
I don't know, Jake, I don't believe that these people can manipulate gold to start with. Why do I say that? Because the powers that be actually don't care about gold. They actually believe, as Warren Buffett has said, that it's like a pet rock, that it's like an anomaly. It's like, people used to collect bottle caps. And so, idiotically, the U.S. has 261 million bottle caps. There used to be a guy, look, for many years, people have been indoctrinated and taught that gold is like a figment of your imagination. It's a pet rock. I mean, who's stupid enough to take it out of the ground in South Africa to put it back into the ground in a bank vault? That was something they used to say. There used to be a fool who I knew kind of, he's dead now, named Elliot Janeway. And he thought, if the U.S. government didn't control gold at $35 an ounce, it would fall to $8 an ounce. How he got that figure, I don't know. But no, I don't think anybody's controlling gold. They don't care about it. They don't believe in it. They think people that do are morons. No, they don't care about gold. They're going to have a big surprise because I hate to be continuing bullish on gold when it's $1,700 and something dollars an ounce, because I started buying it at $35 an ounce. So it seems pretty expensive from that point of view. But yeah, it's going higher. I think it's going a lot higher. Although I hate to buy things that have gone up a lot. But I'm not betting on gold going up. I'm betting on the dollar collapsing and gold being reinstituted as day-to-day money. I think it's going to happen. After we get through a period of time when we have a police state in the U.S. and around the world, when who knows if they'll make gold illegal. I mean, look, we're in terra incognita here. Anything could happen. I mean, look, let me give you a little bit of background here. In 1910, I mean, Europe was peaceful, prosperous, civilized. I mean, it was a great place. By 1920, you know, they'd killed millions of people. They destroyed the continent, and the terrain was totally different, with everything from the Soviet Union being created to empires falling. And then, in another 20 years, you had World War II, totally different again. You know, 1930, the Great Depression, 10 years changed a lot, and then by 1940 to 1950, a different world again. So I don't think I'm at risk in saying that, especially now, in 10 years, the world is going to be as unrecognizable, more unrecognizable than it was in the past in those instances I just gave.
What do you think the probability, you said a police state, what is the probability of that occurring and how far underway is the process?
Extremely, extremely high that it's going to occur, and it's well underway. I mean, the fact that they passed this ridiculous COVID bill for $1.8 trillion, where they're spending this money, I mean, it basically is coming out of the pocket of the average American. Why do I say that? The average American doesn't pay a lot of taxes, but if the average American can save anything, he saves dollars. It's going to destroy the dollar. I was just looking at something this morning. $10 billion, actually, they say, but possibly up to $12.5 billion to reopen K-8 schools. Wait a minute. How many K-8 students are there in the U.S.? I'm going to guess 15 million. So what is that? Let's see. A billion is 1,000 times a million. So what does that mean? They're going to give it takes $1,000 per kid to reopen the schools? Now, this is actually insane, the money they're spending. And it's all going to go into people's pockets, well-connected people, you know, through companies that are hired as consultants and all that. It's, look, they're going to make more laws, more regulations. I mean, we've seen plenty of regulations this last year, and Americans are so hysterical, they'll believe almost anything and do what they're told. No, this is not good.
So if you were me and you were in America, would you be getting out of the country? Where do you get, like, because there's a percentage of my audience that just wants to talk about investment and they don't believe this, that these things are happening and whatever, but I care about it. And so, you know, I'm here, as you know, in Utah, and I'm looking at, you know, do I get out of here really quick or is that doomsday? And then I say, well, do you go to the country and get a farm for a few years and watch how this shakes down over the next couple of years? What's your thoughts?
Well, I eat my own cooking, and I've always been, I've traveled to 155 countries. I've lived in 10 countries. And I'm speaking to you now from a large estancia in Uruguay, where I've got cows and horses and chickens and all of, and a mile riverfront and a big pond with fish. I've got all this stuff. So, there's something to that. But I can still live a civilized life here. The internet works. So, yeah, I think that's intelligent to think about. But I'm sure a lot of your listeners are asking, yeah, okay, that's great, but you got to have money to do that. I need to make some money. Maybe I should buy GameStop tomorrow, and maybe it'll go to $1,000 a share or something like that. More likely, it's on its way to zero. I mean, in the long run, as you know. I don't like to give investment advice per se, but I'll tell you what I'm doing, you know, and I may be wrong because the whole economy might collapse in a runaway deflation. I'm very long gold mining stocks because they're the most volatile class of stocks on the planet, more volatile than tech stocks, which is saying something today. They're the only thing that's cheap in the market. And I think there's going to be a panic into gold and also to silver and hopefully a bubble, hopefully a mania. And I'll be able to blow them all out in a year or two and buy Berkshire Hathaway when it's maybe a half or a quarter of its present price. Make my life simple and easy. That's kind of my plan in a nutshell, okay, other than, you know, living here and enjoying myself. You can't travel anymore. It's impossible to, well, you can, but it's so damn hard international travel now with your testing and, you know, when I left.
As far as I'm aware, Costa Rica is the only place I'm aware of that you can get in without any tests or anything.
Mexico too.
Okay.
And there are places in the Caribbean generally, like the Dominican Republic is also no test. A lot of places in the Caribbean, because they have to, because they're so tourist dependent. But like here in Uruguay, I mean, when I left Miami the last time I went up to the States for a month and a half, trying to get on a plane out of Miami to come down to Uruguay was like trying to get on a plane in Saigon in 1975.
Why?
It was chaos. You know, and that's after you have to spend generally $100-$150 for your stupid PCR test and all that. So now international travel is not what it used to be.
So do you think the best answer is to just find a spot and stay put and see what happens between governments and in the economic system? What do you think?
Look, I'm staying put. I'm just across the Plate River from Argentina. But trying to get to Argentina is almost as hard as getting from the U.S. down here to Uruguay. And it's true of all these damn countries. All over the world, all these governments have locked everything down with testing, but they like it. They like the extra measure of control. It's a huge extra measure of control. This is bigger than the phony war on terror as far as controlling people's concerned. We're a long way from the day as late as the 1980s when if you had a ticket and you could run to the plane before they pulled up the jetway, you were cool. Now you got to get there 2 hours in advance and papers. And it's not going to get better anytime soon. It's going to get worse. So I don't know what we can do about that. I'm just describing reality. I guess most people aren't traveling internationally, but it's a genuine pain today. International travel is still down 75% from what it was a year ago. And I don't see how it's going to get much better. And it's a pain. Even if it gets better, it's going to be awful. So yeah, I'm kind of sticking here.
So you have your International Man newsletter, which I like a lot, and I've befriended your AKA Jim Jeff Thomas. Yep. And I love what you guys write about. And you said you have a good one coming up here. I'll put the link right there down below. Make sure you hit the like button on this side or this side right over there to send this out to more people. Comment down below. Let us know what you think of this episode. And tell me what the topic of this one coming up that you said is so good that you said you're excited about.
I'm just talking about some of my experiences with creatures of the deep state. Because running in the circles I do, I've had some chances to meet high government officials, and the encounters are often amusing. So that's what we're talking about tomorrow.
It'll be entertaining.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, cool. So right there down below is the International Man for everyone to check that out. We'll put the link also to Doug's newest book right there down below, which is called Assassin. And thanks for coming on, Doug.
Okay, Jake. It's always a pleasure talking to you. It's almost as if you're here and we're smoking a cigar together.
I wish I was. I you said there's a couple, George Carlin, you really wanted to meet in person. Definitely. I would like to smoke a cigar with you in person. And so either Uruguay's got to open up their border soon or we'll figure out something else out.